You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
This guy has been working here with these maps for 20-some years, and you can only imagine what that would do to someone. As an Angeleno, you end up locating yourself. You get to know Los Angeles and your place in it, where you're from, where you're going, where Los Angeles was in the past and where it might be in the future. One of the other things that can come out of working with these maps for 20-odd years is a book. And tonight we're going to be looking at images from that book. Glenn Creason, the author of this book this evening, has been a map librarian for the LA Public Library for the past 21 years and a reference librarian in the history department since Jimmy Carter was president. He was co-curator of the Library Foundation's landmark exhibition here at Central Library entitled Los Angeles Unfolded, Maps from the Los Angeles Public Library Collection, and has written about local history, maps, and popular culture for the Downtown News, Mercator's World, The Public Historian, The Communicator, The Los Angeles Times, and our favorite, Edible Ojai. He is the author of Los Angeles and Maps, which is on sale in the lobby, and has been a speaker at local events such as the Society for Professional Journalists, the Center for Land Use Interpretation, a.k.a. CLUI, and the California Map Society. In conversation with Glenn this evening will be DJ Waldy, or as we call him, Don. He's the author of many books, essays, and blogs about Los Angeles and Southern California. He is a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and a contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times. You may have seen his piece in the op-ed section the other day on Los Angeles and maps. His book reviews and commentary have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. He has lectured on the social history of LA, locally and internationally. He blogs at KCET/voices. His most recent book is California Romantica, which was developed in collaboration with Diane Keaton. DJ's Don is a bit of a rock star historian of Southern California. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce or welcome Glenn Creason to the LA Public Library, but he's been here for 20 years. So say hello to Glenn and welcome Don Waldy back to the LA Public Library.
They're cheering for maps, Glenn.
I hope so. I just want to let the people that are here from Southgate know that the announcement said I was appearing with a DJ, but I'm not going to be rapping. Oh, yeah. That might help. Everybody hear me? Okay. Well, should we get started?
Yes, there's a lot of ground to cover. And we... Oh, come on. This is a tough crowd.
I haven't seen this many librarians since Giovanna gave pizza to the staff. Let's see. Well, I wanted to start with this. This is just a regular old tourist map, but Don and I are both from Southeast County, Los Angeles, the underlooked and ignored part of Los Angeles. And this is typical. Everything on one side of the Harbor Freeway does not appear. That's Lakewood and Southgate.
That's right.
So this is where we both came from, the same general area.
Generally speaking.
Except that when you do well in Southgate, you move to Lakewood. This is, this is just our little joke. The blue circle is where DJ Waldy has lived in those other
Those are all my travels in the blue circle.
I never left Los Angeles, but I just moved around a lot whenever the rent was due.
So we have this. We have the situation here where we've got a Footloose Glenn and Barnacle Don But the map does give us and give you a good sense of some of the dynamics of everyday life in Southern California, in the big thing we call L.A.
We're going to start. This is the very first. This is Los Angeles before it was Los Angeles. So this is a map done by an eccentric cartographer.
Many eccentric cartographers there are.
Yes. Yes. It's the Kirkman-Harriman map, and what this map does is it shows the Native American presence in Southern California, which was really substantial. There was about 5,000 members of the Tongva Indians in this vicinity. The map, well, it was done in 1938, so you have to bear with the historical accuracy. The villages are marked by little teepees, but these are the different villages, and the main village was somewhere near, well, it's where it's the Hollywood Freeway now, but it was El Aliso, which was a big sycamore tree where the tribe would gather and they would make decisions.
Right now, that's the middle of the freeway. But this map is also interesting for another reason, because it does suggest that the character of development in Southern California and in the Los Angeles area has been much the same for hundreds of years, in that the settlements of the Native Americans in the region parallel the settlements of Spanish and Mexican Los Angeles, and ultimately parallel much of the development of suburban Los Angeles. And specifically, the trade routes and transportation routes of the Native American population of Southern California and our current freeway network and major highway network overlap pretty well.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you can see some of the freeways. If you just look at this, you'll see the 210 freeway, the Harbor Freeway, the Hollywood Freeway. You can actually take this map and overlay it, and you'll see that. Although he does identify in the north La Crescenta. I don't know exactly where that's supposed to be, but he also has, on this map, he'll have battles marked with the little swords crossed, including the second La Providencia. That was a battle where the battles that took place around Los Angeles were always very friendly because they were between friends and relatives. So they tended to shoot into the air or lob cannonballs. In that battle, I think they injured a mule and killed a horse, and that was it for.
And this map, too, Glenn, isn't this rather important, because there aren't very, very many maps, although this is somewhat late, very many maps that have this many layers of historical material in them. I mean, very few maps have this deep look into the history of the region.
I know that Harriman was actually, he was one of the first people to care for the indigent in the city of Los Angeles, and ran what is now Rancho Los Amigos, which was the county farm. And so I have a feeling he did a lot of the research, although there's a booklet that goes along with this map, which doesn't actually give him too much credit. But anyway, this is just a joke that I threw in, which I thought was interesting. I was looking at the, Rizzoli seemed to say in the publicity that I had Spanish explorers maps, which I really never did. But this is De Anza's trail. When he came through here, which I thought was interesting, since he seemed to take the 101 to the 134.
And that's right. there were at least two cigalerts in 1769.
Yeah. Then he jumped on the 60.
Yeah.
The next period of Los Angeles before it was Los Angeles is the Rancho period. I chose this map just because it's so fun to look at. It's beautiful, makes great wall cover, but it just perfectly describes the way Southern California was laid out in the Rancho period, since it's just Los Angeles County. So I think the first Rancho was, the Spanish Rancho was 1784. That was Don Jose Dominguez. And really what it was is he just approached the the governor, the Spanish governor, and said, I'd like to have land to graze my cattle on, and they said, okay. Except that land might extend to the Pacific Ocean from, you know. And then when Mexico took over, they also they gave these ranchos. But part of what we're talking about here is how Los Angeles spread and why there is this character of Los Angeles of people see the city as spread out. And that's part of it, is because the ranchos were completely self-sufficient, and they had their own stores, their own schools. They had their own wineries. That was an important thing. Blacksmith, carpenters, and all that. And at the center of this map, you'll see there's this square, and that's the city lands. I think I'll leave that to you. The what the city lands meant and where that comes from.
Well, in the creation of Los Angeles in 1781, lands were apportioned to the first settlers, and they were apportioned in two ways. They were given town lots, a house lot in town, and they were given what were called suertes. They were given lots in the agricultural area, which was not terribly far away from downtown, more in the bed of the then Los Angeles River, or the Rio de Portiuncola. And apportioning out of the lots was done by lot. They cast lots and they got lots for their lots, and as a consequence, the city, the pueblo of Los Angeles, was laid out according to high-minded Enlightenment principles of the Bourbon monarchy of Spain, that had read its copy of Vitruvius, and it knew that every city should be laid out at a 45-degree angle to the cardinal points of the compass, because some versions say the four winds blow from north, south, east, and west, so you had to cock the streets to keep the winds from sweeping down them and making them unpleasant to walk on, as if the winds always blew from north, south, east, and west. The other reason, probably more likely, is that small houses in colonial New Spain didn't have much to them. They were simply adobe blocks, and by canting the streets in a 45-degree angle, you got better lighting on both sides of the house throughout the day and throughout the year. But because of the way the bluff behind the new pueblo of Los Angeles runs, and because of the way the LA River runs, the city wasn't able to be laid out with a correct 45-degree angle of disorientation, and only about 36 degrees of disorientation. And if you don't believe me, you can go stand in front of the Biltmore Hotel, not too far from here, and look at the compass rose and set in the sidewalk, and it'll prove to you that downtown is crooked. And it's always been crooked. And what's even more interesting, it will always be crooked. So here's what's interesting. I'm making you laugh, but I'm also making a point, and that is that decisions that you see made more than 150 years ago are still present in the landscape. And when one of the reasons why a book of maps is both funny and touching and also revealing is that how much the maps indicate to us how the past is still present with us. The past is not very far away.
Well, one of the funny little facts that I discovered in researching this map is, as these, we'll get to this later, but as the ranchos were cut into pieces, and the history of Los Angeles is like a history of subdivisions, the cities were born out of these ranchos, like San Rafael, which was owned by the Verdugo family, that later became Glendale. And when they voted what they wanted to name it, Glendale apparently went out by a slim margin over Minneapolis.
Thank goodness.
Is Pat Spencer here? Oh, yeah. This I included just so that you would see how important it is that title insurance did that ranchos map, because this is a diseño. This is what their maps look like. When they would survey a rancho, it would look like this. It'd just be a man on a horse riding out there, and, you know, it's out 8 miles from the stream and so forth. And it gets terribly complicated.
In fact, surveying was not a fine art in Spanish and Mexican Los Angeles. Commonly, rancho lands were surveyed by two horsemen on racing horses with a long length of rope between them, a known length of rope, and they would hopscotch one horse against the next one, and then again and again, and pretty much as fast as they could go, in order to measure out the miles, the leagues of land owned by a particular, or claimed, I should say, by a particular property owner. So in the early American period, in the 1850s, the problem with the crude diseños is that American buyers wanted surveyed land, and the californios, the now American Mexicans who owned the land, had a difficult time proving that they actually owned all those many, many miles of rancho land that they had always thought they did own.
Well, this is an example, but this is a different kind of an example, but it's sort of a mixture of the two. When this is also involves the mission system, and that was like the first outpost of civility that were here. And basically in the 1830s, they secularized the missions, and people ended up buying that property, and it became other ranchos. What's the treaty between U.S. and Mexico at the end of the Mexico?
Guadalupe Hidalgo.
They agreed to, the Californios agreed to recognize the Mexican lands, but unfortunately, when statehood came, they had to prove ownership again. And this map is what's called the land case map, and this is presented as a court case. And these things would, a lot of these bankrupted the owners
Indeed.
Of the property.
It's hugely expensive to survey the land, very difficult to hire the lawyers to go back to Washington, D.C., where the commission met, and most of the Californios, most of the rancheros, went into deep debt to pay for all of that. And when the court cases dragged on, those proud men and women lost most of their land, and many of them became impoverished and indigent. They lived as poor residents of the bad part of Los Angeles, the time called Sonora Town.
And this is William Workman, who had a sorry end himself. And this case dragged on for 15 years, the one that this map represents.
That was not unusual for those cases to take 12 to 15 years.
Well, we're going to move on to anybody who... This is the first sketch made of Los Angeles. This was made by a German artist who was working for... trying to find rail routes between the Mississippi River and the Pacific Coast. And as he came by, he did a lot of these. It's a big, thick report, and Los Angeles was one of the places he passed by.
This is 1859?
1853, so this is after statehood, but you can see that's the, basically the plaza there. Of course, we don't have a pointer. We could point at where Alvera Street is now, but it was then called, I think, Wine Street. But that's basically what the city looked like at statehood. So there wasn't a whole lot of need for mapping, actually. You could just kind of stand there and say, up there, by those sheep up there on that hillside. But you can see that the one building with the spire there, that is the plaza, that's the church. And there, the Lugo Adobe is on there, Sanchez Street. I think the oldest building in Los Angeles is on this map, the Avila Adobe.
You can also see that by this period, by 1853 or so, the fine-grained Enlightenment era layout of Los Angeles gets a little shaggy and ragged, and a lot of homeowners and builders have encroached into the plaza area, so that what was a fairly neat rectangle, and now looks a bit chopped up.
Yeah, it was pretty Wild West atmosphere there, too. I read one account of Abel Stearns at a party, and party crashers came, and they discouraged them by firing shots into the crowd. Anyway, this next map, now we are actually becoming Americanized, sort of. And this is, if anybody, I'm sure there's lots of people in this room that read D.J. Waldie's essay in the Los Angeles Times last Sunday about the ORD survey. And we literally could talk the whole hour on this
particular map.
I told him, before I knew he was writing an essay, I told him, I have a love-hate relationship with that map. I've had to answer so many questions with it.
Well, what's important about this map is that it brings the Spanish and Mexican City into the orbit of the American experience, and it confirms certain facts on the ground, maintains the Spanish and Mexican colonial orientation of the city. That's why this map does not have a conventional north-south axis. In fact, the map is has no relationship to the compass points at all. Although there is a compass grid lightly drawn on it, starting at the front door of the Plaza Church. But what it does do is it takes the Mexican city, the Mexican colonial city, and begins to extend it into its, if you will, its suburbs. And as you can see there on the left, the map becomes very gridded. There we are. And this map is often referred to because of ORD's habit, which carries on for many years on maps of Los Angeles, naming the main streets of the city both in Spanish and in English, so that you have Calle de Aceituna, Olive Street, Calle de la Esperanza, Hope Street. You have supposedly ORD's sweetheart, whom he called Springtime, so you have Calle Primavera, which is now Spring Street. And those Spanish names appear on maps all the way into the late 1870s, kind of interestingly enough, as the city becomes even more Americanized.
And the one street that ran up to the cemetery that was called Eternity.
And there was a Grasshopper Street, too.
Yeah, Grasshopper Street's actually on there. And I fell for the, there's a myth, there's an like a L.A. history myth. There are such a thing as L.A. history nerds. There's quite a lot of
there
them,
are?
As a matter of fact. And that there was a Faith, Hope, and Charity Street.
Yeah, never a...
But there was never a Faith Street, but yeah. There was the others. Yeah. And people eventually didn't like living on Charity, so they changed it to Grand.
To Grand Street.
Yeah. The ORD survey is also, I mean, just the physical part of the ORD survey is there is no original copy of it. It was originally these four sheets of paper put together. This is sort of a version that was done in, I think, 1875, where this is the first time they used the ORD survey, and now you kind of get to see how they're trying to orient it correctly or have it make sense.
Well, now the grid becomes paramount. You can see that the colonial city there in the middle is now surrounded by a gridded landscape. It's not yet oriented to the national grid that was created by the Land Ordinance of 1785 at the urging of Thomas Jefferson. But what was a colonial city now has become real estate. You can see that All those gridded lots north and south, east and west of downtown are now available for profitable sale.
And they're 35 acres, those squares there, that they would sell you for a dollar an acre. 17,000 acres that they were selling. And this is really the first, we're going to talk about this later, hopefully, about so many maps for come-on maps come to Los Angeles. This is one of the first ones that says, we got plenty of good land, come on out. As a matter of fact, they're called donation lots, and that was a thing where you could well, it was called free land, but you paid a small fee, and then you had to improve it, and then you could get title to it after.
And this was the city of L.A. selling its own Pueblo lands, the land that the Spanish crown and the Mexican government had confirmed to the Pueblo of Los Angeles. And so this is how the city filled its coffers, paid off its employees. That they needed money, and so they sold the land. And that's how the city first got, you know, its treasury going.
This is, we're going to move into other maps that were doing that same kind of thing, which, and these are some of my favorite maps of Los Angeles just because they're so colorful and they have so much texture. Unfortunately, this is about as big as we're going to, I'll have a close-up of this, but this is such a perfect map. It's Stevenson's map of 1884, and you can see how now you're really chopping the city up into small parts, and you will notice that the names start changing. This is a plat map, which means it shows ownership, and these are pretty rare. But you can see the river. I see Joe Linton's out there. It's like speaking French in front of a Frenchman. Talk about the river in front of him. But anyway, the river is always the line that breaks East Los Angeles from the other side of the city. But this says there's all kinds of landmarks, but this gives you an idea of the people's names, and you'll see the same names over and over again. And Los Angeles always was a multicultural city. It wasn't something that it just became that in the 80s or something. So there were, as I'm told by a historian, many, many French people, and a lot of French spoken.
Indeed. Yes, indeed.
And other languages. But some of these names you'll recognize. Prudent Beaudry seemed to have a lot of money, so his name's on a lot of things, and Childs, and others. You know, I'm going to go back. I don't know if you can see this, but both of the reservoirs, or what we have as reservoirs now, are like landmarks on this, too. At this point in 1884, there were two institutes of higher learning in the city. One of them was St. Vincent's, that became Loyola, and the other was the Normal School, which was right here. So,
Normal School was the teacher's college.
And I believe it eventually became UCLA, isn't that right?
Yes, it did.
So now we're going to move on to these panoramic maps. This one is not used in the book, but I think it just gives such an incredible vantage point. It goes from the Pacific Ocean all the way to the Santa Monica Mountains, and this is the city in 1877. So this is a year after the railroad had the first railroad connected the city, and that's the railroad down from San Francisco,
yeah. And
that's another contingent we have. We discussed we have our FOMERs, their railroad historians, and God forbid we give the wrong date on one of these. But there was a railroad before that. Phineas Banning built a railroad that ran down to the harbor. And, you know, people saw right away that was going to be the way to make money. We're also not going to do the harbor, but when I looked at this map closely, I was very surprised. There's one of the things that they would always do on a panoramic map. They're trying to get people to move here. They want to show people that there is industry. So there's always a smokestacks, belching smoke. You know, you probably wouldn't want to sell that today. But and then they'll show public buildings. You know, to demonstrate that it's civilized
and up and coming town.
Yes, and churches. And if you look down in the at the list here of places, it says a Jewish church.
What's Brooklyn Heights?
Brooklyn Heights is like Boyle Heights.
Boyle
now.
Heights, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Indeed.
Now, this is the panoramic map is was done by Elliot, and this is was a sort of a style of mapping that was very popular in the Victorian era. So it went. There's one of Los Angeles done in 1857, and they sort of have certain components. But the funny thing about these panoramic maps is they're not terribly accurate geographically, but they're created to make people want to live here. So this is a city of about 65,000 people. They always would ring the map with the public impressive-looking public buildings. So that's City Hall. The other thing I like about this map is that right next door to City Hall is the Women's Christian Temperance Building called the Temperance Temple.
Didn't have much influence on City Hall, by the way.
This is a close-up. Also, this map, it's kind of fun because this is on the Library of Congress website, and you can actually pull this up on the internet and zoom in and look at a single building, which is really quite interesting. And this shows Fort Moore Hill and part of Bunker Hill. It's just, to me, it really gives you a feeling of what everyday life was like. That's the Castellar Street there. That's the new high school, Los Angeles High School.
And one aspect, this map is selling something about Los Angeles to people who might want to live here. And it's selling a prosperous up-and-coming city with modern buildings and everything in proper order. But it's also selling a notion of the city in a garden. It's presenting Los Angeles as a particular kind of Edenic place. And it's making that point subtly but persistently. And that's part of the message that maps of Los Angeles have been communicating since at least this period, if not before. This is a map designed to sell Los Angeles, not as empty farmland to be improved. It's selling Los Angeles as a place to settle down and lead a different kind of life. The invention of the LA lifestyle, which became our most important product.
Yes. Now, I just threw this in just because I think it's so sad. At the very top of the map, way up the edge of town, is the orphan's home. It just looks so forlorn out there. And then those other places right behind it, this shows you what the perspective is like on these maps. There's Downey, Pico Rivera, and Santa Ana. And then the San Pedro Bay is right behind there. Actually, I think it's this one or another one where Catalina appears to be like 500 feet offshore.
This is like that famous New Yorker magazine cover with the rest of the country seen from Manhattan. This is the rest of L.A. seen from downtown.
There's actually one like that for California, too. But anyway, this is, to me, a masterpiece. This is a bird's-eye map from 1909. And again, this is another one that's on the Library of Congress website. Unfortunately, it doesn't go east of the river. And that's typical, too, of these panoramic maps, is that they focused on the areas that were developed. But this now you've got a city of about 300,000. This was done, a man walked the streets of Los Angeles for 15 months to create this map. And you see the kind of detail that he has.
Astonishing detail.
That in the middle there, that's Pershing Square.
At the time called Central Park.
Yes, when it was really nice, not like now. And if you see way over in the upper left-hand corner, Hollywood is there. And that's when Hollywood was a different place. It was actually a dry city full of churches, not very much fun.
A couple of other things are going on in this map. This is a map of Los Angeles shortly after the San Francisco earthquake. And you can see that for the next several decades, this is what the height limits in L.A. were going to be. The town of 1910 was very much the city in terms of the way it developed, with a relatively low-rise downtown surrounded broadly by one and two, three-story buildings that sort of on into infinity. So the city of 1910 is the one that lived and was lived in up until the early 1960s.
Yeah, this, oops. Well, you can't, it's really hard to see here, but if you look in the upper right-hand corner of this map here, that's Angel's Flight. You see that slope? So that's still there.
It was steeper in the past. You know, most of the hills in Los Angeles have been planed down over the decades, and some hills have been removed entirely. Pound Cake Hills is no longer there.
Yeah. What was the date of this one? 1909. This map just focuses on downtown, but it's such a interesting the way it's drawn. It's like orthographic projection, and it's. This is a guy named Robert Marsh. Strangely enough, a lot of the early cartographers of Los Angeles were realtors, you know, proud and happy realtors. And this guy was trying to sell commercial real estate. And this is 1913, so the city was starting, you know, there was oil. They were doing a lot of building. There were cars.
The port had opened. The Panama Canal would open the following year. This was a city poised on the threshold of its biggest industrial expansion that occurred during the First World War and in the 1920s.
But you can see as a landmark, there's Pershing Square. It's not Pershing Square yet, but Central Park. And, of course, we had excellent public transportation, and they actually this year, 1913, was I believe the first movie at the Orpheum in downtown. Well, at least they were showing them, and in the middle of this map, I don't know that you can see it, but it was Hamburger's Department Store, and it was advertised as having a moving staircase.
That's right.
Yeah. Like we have here at Central Library that doesn't work all that much.
Now.
Well, we're going to move on to one of the main topics of LA history, which is water. And always was essential. And this first map, even though it's not too pretty, I did add the blue there. That's the. As soon as the city was settled in 1781, they immediately started digging ditches off of the LA River to create what they called zanjas. And this is a map that shows the Zanja Madre, which was the big one. And then there's a lot of offshoots from this.
The Zanja Madre provided water, and its offshoots provided drinking water, provided water for agricultural purposes. People washed themselves, their animals, and their clothes and their dishes in that water. It was an all-purpose ditch.
Yeah. And water was so dear at that point that sometimes it would cost you 50 cents for a bucket. So that probably doesn't mean there was a lot of bathing either.
Well, maybe not.
And it was fed by gravity, so there was a couple of water wheels, but it passed kind of along North Broadway, from what I imagine, all the way down to like 5th in Los Angeles. I think that's... Anyway, the funny thing about this map is when you look at it, it refers to the river as the Rio Porcincula, or Porcincula, however it's pronounced.
Porcincula.
That's much better. But the offshoots, they just say ditches.
Yeah.
So...
The river didn't become the Los Angeles River until fairly late in the American period. And then because, I guess, Porciuncula was a little hard to say.
Yeah. Well, this is a very blurry close-up of it, but you see these hatched lines in the right side. That's the Zanja Madre as it passes through. And one of the main things they used it for were to irrigate vineyards, because that was one of the first successful agricultural crops that we had.
And were they table grapes, Glenn?
No,
they weren't. The vineyards produced wine, which was distilled into brandy and sold to all those miners up in Northern California.
Yeah. Reminds me of a librarian who used to be in the literature department when I offered her some grapes, and she said, I don't take my wine in pills. Anyway, the water was flowing and it was obvious that it was worth a lot of money and it was very important, then people started trying to develop ways of keeping it. So that's when they actually started thinking about water companies, and I think as early as 1861, they're trying to regulate the water, and they were trying to create these reservoirs. The first person was Prudent Beaudry, and this is a very complicated story, and I would advise people that are interested read Blake Gumprecht's book.
Yeah. It is a very complicated story, but perhaps it could be summed up briefly by saying that finding water and delivering water in Los Angeles was the key to its expansion. And everyone knew it from virtually the first moment that the city began to evolve in the late 1840s, early 1850s. And as a consequence, finding water, controlling water, delivering water, storing water became the overriding concern of city government. And the creation of independent private water companies and the laying of water lines led to decades of conflict and ultimately to the public ownership of the system. It might be worth noting that, of course, all this water came from the Los Angeles River. And even today, about 17% of all the water that is delivered in the city of Los Angeles comes from the aquifers that feed the Los Angeles River. This is San Gabriel Valley. And so when you raise a glass of L.A. water today, you're drinking a little bit of the history of the city as well.
So this is a close-up of what is now, this is Echo Park. And eventually, George Hansen, whose name you see all over the place in Los Angeles history, and the city surveyor, William Moore, they're the ones who finally built this thing. And they had to build a dam over there that then had a 78-foot drop. They ended up creating a mill there. They had a woolen mill. I think that was the very first industry in the city, this woolen mill. I also love William Moore as a historical character because he's the guy who he wanted to take a ship down from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and he was very impatient about it, so he walked from San Francisco to Los Angeles. This is an 1868 map, and the reason, this is where the city's selling off land. They're $80,000 in the hole. So they're going to try to sell off this land. And you can see in this map on the left-hand side, these are the people that bought the property. But the really important thing about this map, these more of these 35-acre parcels, is that the city kept control of the river, of the water. They owned that river and that water, and that's so important. As the city develops, Los Angeles has that water and everybody wants it. And so a lot of the incorporation, a lot of the cities that came in to Los Angeles, they did it to get the water.
What's of interest here is the access and use of water under the Spanish and Mexican colonial systems is different than the use and access to water under the American system. Under the American system, if your property abuts the water, you have a right to that water. That's common water rights under the American system. Under the Spanish and Mexican colonial system, you don't have that right. In fact, in the creation of the city of Los Angeles in the period after 1781, this is the Mexican city of Los Angeles, the Ciudad de Los Angeles, the rights to the water remained with the city. So as the city is being developed in the American period after 1850, the battle is which kind of law will determine who owns the water, Will it be American law that says if your property butts the river, you have access to that water? Or will it be Spanish and Mexican colonial law, which says that the city owns that water? And the city of Los Angeles fought for decades to assert its Mexican rights to the water of Los Angeles River. So we have this, again, a curious survival of history, that the up-and-coming, bright, brand-new, red, white, and blue city of Los Angeles had made a very conscious effort to retain rights that came from its Mexican and Spanish colonial past.
Well, the next problem with water is...
Yes, the other problem with water.
Yeah. Once the city started really growing and there were all these population booms, especially in the 80s, and we needed infrastructure, and that meant all kinds of stuff, anything from paved roads to gas to sewage and flood control, because there was a huge problem with floods in Los Angeles, and the river is always very unpredictable and was flooded and destroyed things. So they decided, and sewage, the sewer systems were a very new thing. It was something they were doing in Europe, and they, I think, in Paris, they figured out some epidemics were caused by improper handling of sewage. So the mayor asked. Here's another name in Los Angeles history you see over and over again, Fred Eaton, who was a city engineer. And he had worked for the L.A. Water Company, the early water company that William Mulholland also was a ditch tender for. So he worked with the different sanitarians, and this guy, Rudolph Herring, and Eaton produced this 23-page report, and this map is in that report. And everything seems kind of hunky-dory, and this is the way it was to look, but there was always a big problem with the outfall, where this sewage was going to
go. Where was the sewer line going to end?
Yeah.
Well, in part, the Eaton and the sanitarians, who were professional dealers with sewage, said that the sewage should flow into the sea through a long outfall tunnel that would carry it rather far off from shore. But the good city fathers of Los Angeles thought that was a bad idea. Water was, of course, a precious commodity. Even used water was a precious commodity. And for many years, the sewer system didn't end at the ocean. It ended sort of in where I live, or thereabouts. And the sewage was spread onto fields. And most of the vegetable gardens of burgeoning Los Angeles in the 1880s and early 1890s, the sewage was sold at a pretty good price to the operators of truck farms, vegetable farms in the southeast part of Los Angeles.
And some Tony real estate, too, that people are living in.
That's right. You know, you never know what you'll find if you dig down deep enough in your backyard.
Well, let's see, what's our next? I have to take a deep breath as we go to the Los Angeles Aqueduct. Okay.
We wish we could give you a really tight view of this, but this is a wonderful map, and it's obviously very, very vertical, so it's rather difficult to get onto a slide.
Yes.
But this shows the entire length of the Los Angeles Aqueduct.
And the river was, it was running dry, and it was overtaxed. They were pulling too much out of it. So by 1904, it's pretty much maxed out, and there's more is being demanded of it than it can supply.
There were actually periods when there were water shortages and water systems were turned off. A couple of dry summer periods in the preceding couple of years, where neighborhoods just had their water turned off because there was no water to supply to them.
So luckily, this mayor, Fred Eaton, who's all over the place, he's camping up in the Owens Valley and sees all that water up there. So he gets the idea. And at first, when he pitched this to Mulholland, he didn't think too much of it. I think they had some other ideas. But eventually, they decided this was going to be their best possibility to bring this water. This would be like the most incredible engineering feat ever. So, and they had to ask Congress to allow them to pass through federal land, and then they had to get the local voters to vote yes on it, and that also meant putting up $3 million, which is a gigantic sum of money. But this is 233 miles that this thing traveled. And I think in one of the books that I read, it listed about 10 different figures, and it's just staggering. You know, they built reservoirs along the way. 118 people were killed. They had 142 tunnels they had to dig through rock. Anyway, part of my favorite, this is sort of the end of the aqueduct. You can see, this is sort of like seeing it after drinking three beers, I think. It's a little fuzzy, but you can see at the bottom, that little square, that's Los Angeles, and there's the...
All that blue leaves that little square.
Yeah. And they had this big thing at the Cascades, out in like the the Newhall Pass, where they opened the chute and let the water come down, and they brought people by streetcar out there and gave them a bottle of water, of official aqueduct water. And that's the famous story where Bill Mulholland, being a great orator, said, "There it is, take it."
And this is the other big story of Los Angeles, how the city grew. Water was essential to that growth, and the Owens Valley Aqueduct, Los Angeles Aqueduct, was confirmed that. And at virtually the same period, the spread of electric trolleys, the street traction systems, there were two of them. There was the Pacific Electric System, which was Henry Huntington's master plan for developing his real estate in Southern California, and then there was a local street railway system called the Los Angeles Railway, or LARI, and that was the street railway that serviced local neighborhoods in Los Angeles. So this is the Pacific Electric System, which is the interurban system, and you can see by this map that it covered the county like paint.
And part of the reason why the Huntingtons had so much money is they knew where these lines were going, and they had a lot of property along
those lines.
Bought the
land ahead of it.
There's stories about people lining up for 48 hours to buy lots in places like Azusa and Monrovia, places that were just the sticks. Suddenly they were accessible, and you could go all the way up to Mount Low and stay in the hotel. And there's all these pictures of people, women in like high button shoes and, you know, wearing wool dresses at the top of Mount Low.
Now, it may be too much to say that the Pacific Electric System sprawled Los Angeles, but it is certainly clear, particularly from this map, that the electric railway, the trolley system, which preceded the automobile, the wide availability of automobiles, particularly by working class people, made it possible for someone to live in a town like Bellflower or Downey or Santa Ana and work in Los Angeles. So you had streetcar suburbs of a particular kind evolving in Los Angeles in the teens, and you can begin to see how the 88 cities of Los Angeles County begin to blossom from the stops along the way of the Pacific Electric.
900 cars, and that meant about 2,700 trains a day coming and going. Well, you know, we were talking when I was nervously pacing around in the green room about how the streetcars, they stopped being able to maintain them, as they started to become degraded, then they were adding buses. So by the 30s, I think there was a lot of buses mixed in, and everybody thinks of Los Angeles traffic as horrible, but it was really bad then.
we think of Los Angeles traffic as bad today on the freeways, but in the 20s, the traffic was impossible downtown, in part because of the number of automobiles on city streets, and they were in competition with the street railway system, the LARRY system, the Los Angeles Railway, and there were endless problems with traffic accidents and pedestrians being killed and motorists running into trolley cars. And unfortunately, when Henry Hunt, the LARRY system, the owners of that tried to sell it several times to the city as a public utility, and the voters turned them down. And after Henry Huntington grew less interested in his properties and his railway system and more interested in his art and his books, both the interurban system, the PE system, and the LARRY system began to experience some problems in maintenance and the upkeep of the rolling stock and the infrastructure.
So that leads into the beginnings of the automobile age. So this is one of the very first, we were talking about, this is called the Automobile and Miners Roadmap, and I always, I looked at this and I thought, how interesting. Well, I should give a little background. This guy, Henry Ruger, did these, another real estate guy, and he did these huge 80-page atlases with, you know, almost like a Thomas guide. I've actually never seen one. I think they have one at the Huntington Library. But this is just a one-pager he did. And when I looked at this map, I thought, you also can see all the roads that exist now, or many of the roads that are freeways and so forth. But this is when we first had automobiles, and the speed limit was 8 miles an hour. So you can see already the idea that you're going to be able to spread out all over the whole area is there. So anyway, when I looked at this map and I see all these dots, I thought, well, these are wells, you know, because it is a miner's map. But actually, those are post offices. So.
And a post office means a town. That's the important thing. I think we have. We might need to move on a little bit.
Okay. Well, this is just the modern day freeways, and we just to touch on that's what we. This is what it has come to. But if you take a look at this, and you put it overlay it over like the Kirkman Harriman map, you're going to see that a lot of these roads, you know, the Mission Road is the Pomona Freeway, the 5 Freeway is Portola's, his path, the 110 going south, that's like Banning's railway, and the 101's the El Camino Real. So I know everybody in this room is probably cursed at these roads, but this is what we ended up with.
This is what the maps gave us.
And part of the sprawl and the movement outward were the first suburbs. So we threw in Angelino Heights.
The very first suburb, really. Didn't succeed too well, this is rather more than actually got built, but some lovely late Victorian houses still there.
They got 51 of them built, so I think it was originally it was to rival Bunker Hill, and it is beautiful. I mean, a lot of these houses are still intact. So
made possible in part because early Los Angeles was noted for its cable car system. There were many cable cars that carried passengers up to these new subdivisions on the Heights.
I like the fact that it says stands high above the fog. I've never thought of L.A. as being like a real
fog.
Oh,
we could talk about fog a lot. There's a lot to be said about fog in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Sure, of course there is. Come on.
Well, another topic is maps that are that brought tourists here. So these are kind of fun. This is my personal favorite. I just love this thing. This was done by this, I guess he was, I mean, the more I look at it, the more strange things I see about it. This was done in 1932, so it's during the Depression. There are two maps in a row that are from 1932, which seemed to be a great year for pictorial maps. And he has the regular tourist things on it, like the Hollywood Bowl, Grauman's Chinese. You can see the Brown Derby is there. But he also has the Crystal Pier nude sunbaths. I don't know. My parents never told me about that one. And it also has, this is a personal note for me and some of my family are here, it shows off the coast the gambling ships.
Oh.
And my father was a craps dealer on the wrecks.
Really?
Yes.
And there's astonishing. There's
another story that goes along with that that I will leave.
Fascinating.
Tell, but, and also the Central Avenue, which was one of the maps in the book, African American street that had some of the greatest nightclubs ever, and he lists those, which normally would not be done on pictorial maps. So this is, and there's also the Temple B'nai B'rith is in there. Lots of interesting things on Leuschner's map. The next one is this is a tourist map too of you can see this is like we were talking about the Southern California experience. This is, just seems to be it right in
exactly.
A nutshell.
Land of sunshine, exactly.
As you can see, it has four components. There's the cornucopia spilling out the abundance. It has flora and fauna. It has California poppies around the edges, yuccas in bloom. It has celebrities. It's got Charlie Chaplin, Pick Fair, that kind of thing. Apparently, Traveler, everybody was horseback riding everywhere on this map. So at Gay's Lion Farm, Costin's Ostrich Farm, all these offbeat kind of places that people don't remember existed anymore.
This is one of the great maps of Los Angeles, which tells the whole story of the city graphically. This is a graphic novel of Los Angeles, if you will, a graphic history of Los Angeles.
You know, the beautiful part about it, too, is that Joe Morrow, he was actually from Uruguay, and he came here. He was a working cartoonist of the Boston Herald when he was like 14 years old, but he went and lived with Indians in the Southwest, and he became an expert on the Californios, and he wrote a book on the Californios, and he knew everything about their costume, everything down to their hairstyles. So everything on this map is accurate, right down to the finest little detail, and he tells the whole thing with quite a sense of humor. Even has, at the bottom, it has the population growth of Los Angeles portrayed by women blowing up big balloons in bathing suits. And this is typical. You can see the detail. You can see there's a little Trojan there for USC, a little Bruin for UCLA. There's a Jesuit for Loyola. In the middle is all the radio stations and so forth.
Gentlemen, shall we go to some questions? This is the voice of God.
Yes, I know.
We actually made it to the end.
We did make it to the end, Justin.
Oh,
so.
Perfect.
We had some other topics, but...
But maybe just a one wrap-up thought, or my wrap-up thought, and I'll throw it back to Glenn for his perhaps a wrap-up thought, is that if you'd go back to the full-scale map for a moment, here again we encounter... A graphic representation of Los Angeles in which the past is not past. The past is immediately present. Radio towers and rancheros on horseback are present simultaneously as layers on this map. And I think if we begin to think about our encounter with place in Los Angeles, we might be instructed by this map so that we, when we look at our landscape, we may enrich that experience by seeing how many layers of history and time each map presents to us, each site of Los Angeles presents to us. So this is a good place to end because it's everything. It's 1781 and it's 1933, and it's all there living simultaneously on a single map. And now we're going to take some questions from our audience. We'll try to be generous in getting that done in all parts of the room. So a question. Sir, in the corner, give us a moment. We're going to get a mic to you so that you can be heard.
I can usually be heard without a mic, but I'll
I guess it. You can.
I was wondering, you said that the height limitations were established in 1910. How much was that shaped by the great earthquake in 1906
yes.
in San Francisco?
Yeah, the San Francisco earthquake actually set the height limits for buildings in Los Angeles, with only the City Hall building being permitted to be taller than the height limit. The tallest building in Los Angeles, apart from City Hall, were a few of the downtown hotels. But those limits were set as a consequence of earthquake fears, and those earthquake fears were driven by the San Francisco earthquake in 1906. Another question. You, sir, or you, ma'am, with your hand up there.
I was wondering if you could, you talk a little bit about it in the book, but since there's so many ladies in the audience, I was wondering if you would speak on Laura Whitlock and her impact on cartography and map copyright.
Well, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't use the Laura Whitlock map because I really prefer it to the one I did use here because she's such an amazing person. First of all, she's the only woman cartographer in the entire country. And she ended up, when the LA Times building blew up, she lost all of her original stuff, but somebody pirated 20,000 copies of the map, and she sued. She took them to court and really had to fight like hell, but she won the case, and this was like the major court case for a copyright for maps. So this woman, Laura Whitlock, is an amazing person. She did two things at once. Plus, that's a great map, and which I didn't find until, like, I had 2 days left to provide art for the book, and I found, unfortunately, she's not here. She's in England, but our rare books librarian gave me this map by Laura Whitlock. So it was total serendipity.
A few more questions. All right, just a moment.
Hi, my name is Alex. I was just wondering, where can I get copies of those maps, especially the last one?
Well, buy the book, and you get a very good, crisp photograph of the map, but full-scale reproductions, not many of those around.
The Joe Mora estate, he died about 5 years ago, and his son, Joe, died in 47. They do not do reprints of the Los Angeles map. But sometimes if you look, I got one, and I didn't pay all that much for it, but there's collectors around, and sometimes you'll get them on eBay. So, but nobody does it commercially. What, they do them for the Grand Canyon, but they're not that good.
Interesting. You, sir.
A comment and a question. Comment. In the LA Times, there was talk about how the Spanish had a 45-degree angle for light and air, which seems much more humane than an orthogonal Cartesian coordinate. And I wondered if you could say something about that.
Well, as I said in my piece, it's the two imperial imaginations. You had the American imperial imagination and the Spanish imperial imagination, and they collided on the streets of Los Angeles. I don't know if one is better than the other. It's just the way they imagine the world.
And why is it that south of Vernon, all of the major thoroughfares are 1,400 apart, whereas in central L.A., on out through Cahuenga Boulevard West, and all through the San Fernando Valley, it's 800.
I'm glad you're answering.
Boy, that's a a fascinating question for which I have no answer. But, you know, that's I will now try to find out. That's a really interesting question. I don't know why the numbering system is different in different parts of the region. There should be a pretty standard numbering system. I don't know. More questions. Somewhere in the back? Anyone? You, sir.
Oh, when you were talking about the Owens Valley and Mulholland, the aqueduct, I was taken back to an event here a couple of months ago where Pat Morrison and Bill Boyarsky were talking about the Chandlers. And I seem to recall that they were fairly persuasive and influential in the development of the aqueduct. Indeed. And I wonder if you could comment on that at all.
Yes. Well, that story is complex, but has been told and is being told in a variety of both popular and scholarly works. General Otis and Chandler, his son-in-law, and as well as a number of other influential business people in Los Angeles, knew that the Owens Valley Aqueduct was going to be built and knew its general course because they sat on the boards of various commissions and bodies that that helped determine what the aqueduct line of development would be. And they knew that the aqueduct would ultimately end up in the San Fernando Valley. So ahead of the completion of the aqueduct, they bought up large tracts of land in the San Fernando Valley. It has been said, and I do not know if it is true, that they caused the aqueduct to end in the San Fernando Valley. That's probably not specifically true, but they knew it was going to end in the San Fernando Valley, and therefore they bought the land up. That precipitated the annexation of the San Fernando Valley by the city of Los Angeles so that it had that land added to its land area. So the Chandlers and their business partners and confederates in development projects used insider knowledge to enrich themselves by buying land around the terminus of the aqueduct, and that may be what can be mostly said about them. Their activities may be more nefarious than that, but that's at least the part that I think is true.
They also had a big part in the tourism. They started the first real tourism bureau.
Chamber of Commerce and the All Year Club.
All Year Club, yeah.
Were big parts of that. More questions? Yes, ma'am, down in front. Wait, I think the microphone's coming from here, on the other side.
My question is, during the Spanish times, the center of the city was the plaza,
yes.
The church, right?
Yes.
But under American rule, did they change the center of the city and when they stopped numbering the city?
The center of Los Angeles stayed very much the plaza up until the arrival of the first transcontinental railway connection from San Francisco to Los Angeles in 1876. And by the time of the arrival of direct east-west communication in 1888, the center of Los Angeles was beginning to move west and south from the old plaza. And by the 1900, the old plaza was very much just a kind of desultory area for impoverished residents who lived in the area where now Union Station is located in Chinatown. And with the start of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, the plaza became associated with fiery speeches and rabble-rousers and radical politics, and the rabidly anti-red rabidly anti-union Los Angeles Times characterized the old plaza of Los Angeles as being a hotbed of sedition and radical thought. So the plaza persisted as the center of the city well into the American period, but by 1900, 1910, it was no longer that kind of place.
The numbering system starts where?
You know, I honestly don't know where the numbering system starts.
City Hall.
City Hall starts at City Hall. I thought it started at City Hall.
First
in Main, yeah. which is not the old plaza either. Yeah.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have left this evening. But there are many many questions can be answered by looking in this book out here and buying it.
Buying and then looking, okay?
Justin.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.